what's going on today. It only took me like 35, 40 minutes. It usually takes me almost an hour to get in, but nobody seems to be on the road.
Because everybody's riding their bicycle.
Is that what? Yeah, because it's such a beautiful day. It's just a Friday.
No, this is ride your bike to work day.
Oh, really? Uh-huh. That's a real thing.
That is a real thing.
All right. That's very nice. Well, we're all here, and as far as I know, none of us rode our bike to work, but that's all right. Let us introduce the group, and then we'll get into some really interesting discussions. First, we welcome WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. I'm speaking to you from an undisclosed location. It is not Great Barrington, and it is not East Floyd.
Okay. Well, that would be great. I want to open an East Floyd bureau now. We should set up shop there. Author, activist, Barbara Smith is with us. Good morning, Barbara. Always a delight to have you on our program.
Thank you so much. Thank
good
you morning.
Very much. And corporate attorney Rich Honan joins us. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning.
Great to have you back. Thank you very much. I do want to start with this because I forgot it yesterday, and I want to make sure that we mention it, and we have something to crow about, so let's do this. I don't know if you knew this, Alan, but as of 9 a.m., which was just moments ago, the lockbox went over $160,000.
That's terrific. And, you know, it's good, but it's not good enough. We have to beat the record, Joe. We have to get to that $400,000, and we get an extra $5,000 from Tony Miola, a wonderful man who wrote me yesterday and said, I can't believe the amount of attention I'm getting here.
Well, Tony is not only a wonderful supporter and contributor to WAMC, but also is an active part of our roundtable discussions. And we'll often write in and share his thoughts as well. So we love that he's a part of this. So, yes, a $5,000 challenge, which is nothing to sneeze at. And we are at $160,000. So before June 6th, we need to get to the $400,000 point to get that $5,000. And the fund drive, pretty much we could do that before it even starts. And you get the vote package. Barbara, you may be the only person who hasn't seen this yet.
No, I haven't.
This is the vote package is a...
Oh, that's nice.
A T-shirt that says, vote for WAMC.
In fact, it's more than nice. It's elegant and necessary.
Nice? And realizing that you can't wear the T-shirt all the time, we also have it. It will also come with a convenient mug format. And you can bring that with you everywhere. And for $100, we'd love to give you the vote package. And the money's coming in, and we hope it continues to, and all is well. So we thank you very much for that, and we hope we have a really great weekend, too. WAMC.org.
Remembering, Joe, that really we just can't do it if we don't have the money. And if everybody does just a little, and I'm passionate about this, as you know, if we have everybody does just a little, we can't be stopped.
Well, and if you think about it, if sure, you can give us $100, we'll give you the mug, we'll give you the T-shirt, that's great. But whatever you can do, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do helps immensely as we try to get to this goal. And as Alan indicated, you know, if we don't do it, then we're not here.
It's pretty simple.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty simple. Okay, we have many issues to talk about. Let's get to them, and we'll talk about what is happening in our world. I guess we should probably start with what is happening with yesterday. We spoke of the Egypt airplane. Wreckage has now been found. This comes about 12 hours after they said they found wreckage, and then it turned out not to be the wreckage of that plane, and it turned out to be something else, which I don't really know what that was or how you misidentify that, but they did. Now they're starting to find passengers' belongings and debris that has been spotted about 180 miles off of the coastal city of Alexandria. And I think, again, we don't know what happened, and we were using the term yesterday of mindless speculation, which is what Ira Fussfeld posited, that many of the cable news networks and so forth do when something like this happens and you just don't know. With that said, there are many officials coming forward and saying that this seems to be an act of terrorism, and while certainly not confirmed, is certainly the leading factor that they're investigating. Alan, any thoughts on this?
Well, you know, it seems that way to me. Pardon me. One of the first rules of life is never eat a whole wheat roll before you go on the radio. Okay, but but I can tell you this, that I rejected Ira's mindless speculation. I mean, I don't think that, I think this is, Hillary Clinton comes out, she says it's terrorism, it's okay with me. Somebody wrote me a note this morning and said, you know, there were people who came out and said Charles Manson was guilty before the trial. And I wrote back and said, wasn't he?
Right. Well, you know, the other thing, to Alan's point, or excuse me, to Ira's point, is that, you know, we see, because we're watching in the studio now, we have the CNN on, and it's just, it is, you know, they've been on now for 24 hours, kind of regurgitating the same thing over and over and over again, of talking about this, and if this person did it, and that person did it, and these, and I guess that is ultimately, I think, what he meant and what we've been talking about. So we have to be, we do have to be careful, but we also have to look at this and say, all right, what are all the possibilities? And this is one of them. Would you?
Well, I heard the show yesterday, and I heard that phrase, mindless speculation. I guess, I think the Charles Manson situation is a little bit different, because that was a murder scene, and probably things connected that murder scene to the individual. I think when a plane disappears, it's just a little more difficult. I mean, it's moving pretty quickly since they actually have found debris from the plane itself. But one of the things about that 24-hour news cycle, they don't assume that anybody's sitting there watching it for 10 hours. They repeat the same thing over and over again. They have their experts on in the same sequence every hour, and I think it's kind of, that's the way it is. I'm not making a case for them doing it, nor am I saying that they shouldn't do it. I'm just saying that it's kind of how you have a 24-hour news station.
Yeah, and in the case of plane crashes, sadly, that it seems the more so, kind of, it feeds into it. It's and CNN especially is very into aviation crashes. I know they have the former FAA chief and everything.
They have four aviation correspondents.
But I think part of that is, you know, there is an immediacy, you know, as news breaks. But the problem is, as Barbara says, the news really isn't breaking. You know, they're just you know, re-summarizing each hour. And we hang on, and then all that's left to do is speculate, and the speculation is, you know, uninformed, because we don't know anything more than what's been reported.
So one of the things I wanted to get to, Alan, I have a request letter. Do you have your device in front of you?
Well, I have one thing. I actually have my cell phone. It says, ahem, we are all clearing our throats for Alan.
Okay, so a couple down from that is a letter from Mike.
Go ahead, read it.
And it says, is it too much to ask that the two leading politicians running for their party's presidential nominations wait until some facts, all in uppercase letters, come in before shooting off their mouths about what they think happened to the Air Egypt plane? First Donald Trump, then Hillary Clinton talked about the possibility the terrorists brought down this aircraft. Is it too much to ask that they wait? Yes, I guess it is. Snap judgments lead to mistakes in judgment.
Well, that's true. But on the other hand, you know, and I'm going to stick with my own position on this. We've seen this before. We know what these people want. We know what they say they're going to do. It's not too much. Now, in terms of the politics of the situation, you better believe that Hillary and the Donald are both saying we can not afford to be perceived as being soft on these folks. I'm sure that's what this is all about. Mike probably has a point. On the other hand, it is politics, and nobody wants to lose an election because they were late to the game.
Are there really that many people who, upon hearing this, upon hearing the area of the world that it was in, upon hearing kind of almost the dearth of information, are there that many people who did not think in the first few seconds, wow, I wonder if this was terrorism or not?
Yes, that's logical.
Yeah. I don't know. And I don't think that either Trump or Hillary were saying anything other than it's not inconsistent with what we've heard in the past.
But you hear the same thing.
And they're just saying the same thing everybody else is thinking.
But you guys are great. And you put it very, very nicely. It might be terrorism. That wasn't what I was thinking. I was thinking this is terrorism.
It's
so I know you're trying to get me off the hook, but that's what I was thinking.
Well, you know what I was thinking is, to Richard's point, and I think it's a good one, is that if a rock star dies at 50 years old,
right,
do we just sort of assume that it was a drug overdose? Sure. But we keep on saying, well, we won't know until the toxicology right. reports come back. We won't know until this, and then information leaks out, and then, well, not always, but many times, what does it show us? Well, that it was a drug overdose. So, yeah, I think there are those things that you have, but I also think we have to be careful in what we say if we don't know, if we don't have
right.
the complete facts. I thought the Egypt Air officials were taking a lot of criticism yesterday for saying that it was a missing plane as opposed to, even though they said they had found some debris. And their point was, okay, but until we find, like, until we actually see the debris and we know where it is, it's still missing to us.
Right.
Like, we don't know where it is. It's missing. And I sort of understood that argument.
Well, I'm sorry, Barbara, but one point, and that is that this comes a day after Al-Sisi announces that he and Netanyahu have been in touch about getting things started, peace talks started again. That's extraordinary to me. That's some coincidence.
I think that the tone of the two candidates' remarks about terrorism were somewhat different.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, and yes. I think we'll continue to see that difference in tone from now till November, right?
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have other issues to talk about, and we'll get to those issues in just a moment. We welcome your letters, roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Spicer Art Conservation. Art conservation of textiles, objects, paper, and upholstery, serving private owners and institutions since 1995, treating heirlooms and antiquities, 518-765-2142. Zimmer Brothers Jewelers, Poughkeepsie and Rhinebeck, a curated selection of fine and estate jewelry for life's celebrations, jewelers since 1893, zimmerbrothers.com. And MKC Kitchen and Bath Center, Troy, offering a range of cabinetry including showplace wood products, countertops, design services, and showroom, mkckitchens.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. And Alan Chartok, Barbara Smith, and Rich Honan making up the group this morning. We move on to some other topics, and I want to talk about, we'll do this before the break, and that is a new poll. This is from the New York Times. A New York Times CBS News poll shows that an overwhelming majority of Republican voters say their party's leaders should get behind Donald Trump, even as he enters the general election saddled with toxic favorability ratings among the broader electorate. And as Mr. Trump faces deep skepticism with general election voters and some Republican holdouts, the Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton is grappling with Senator Bernie Sanders and how to win over his impassioned supporters. So what do you make of the poll, Alan?
Are we surprised? I mean, he wins overwhelmingly. He beats the hell out of his opponents. And when you ask the people who voted for him, should the other Republicans get behind him and the official Republicans get behind him? The answer is yes. Astounding, isn't it?
Is that who they polled, though? They only polled people who voted for him?
No, they voted. They polled Republicans, and that's what they reported on.
Okay.
And overwhelmingly, Barbara, Republicans want the party to get behind Trump.
Which I would assume is very similar to Democrats who want the Democratic Party to be unified in one way or the other, right?
No, I don't think so, because I think the Democrats, there's still a race going on. At least it's going to be a race until Bernie says it's not a race anymore. And so those people are, you know, really quite angry, quite involved. And that's very different from a presumptive nominee.
I'm looking at you, Barbara, because the question I want to ask you is, knowing your support of Bernie Sanders, is do you think it is time for some coalescing, or are you comfortable with where your candidate is at this point?
I am ambivalent because, you know, as the days go on and Trump ratchets up his insane diatribes, it's just, it becomes ever more frightening. On the other hand, I think that Bernie's doing a great job, and I think that he should continue to run until the last primary. It's going to be difficult because there's such divisions, clearly, in the Democratic electorate. Yeah, are either people who might be a part of the Democratic electorate. The question about the millennials, and will they ever attach to any kind of electoral politics in the future is a really good question.
Alan, we're going to go to the BBC News, and I want to come back. I want to get your thoughts, and I also want to talk about, there was a Hillary Clinton interview with Chris Cuomo last night on CNN in which he said something interesting that I want to talk to you all about as well. We'll get to that. We're going to be back in just about 3 minutes. We're going to hear news from the BBC. We welcome your letters, roundtable at WAMC.org, and we will continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. This morning, we are with Alan Chartok, Barbara Smith, and Rich Honan, and we welcome your letters, roundtable at WAMC.org. Alan, I paused you right before we started. Do you?
Yes, I had a question for Barbara.
Yes.
If it's all right. Barbara said she thought that Bernie ought to keep going at least until the last primary. My question to Barbara is, what if Bernie wins that last primary? In other words, what if Bernie wins in California, even though statistically he can't make it?
Well, I think there's another part of the discussion that we didn't have. I'm glad that you did ask me, and that's what impact will Bernie's candidacy and his campaign have upon the Democratic convention? So if he wins, my understanding is that there's already been some reach out about what they will have him be doing at the convention and how much airtime and you know, like time to just express his particular, you know, his stances. That conversation has already begun, but it seems to me that that's a part of at least a part of the answer to the question that you're raising, which is whether he wins California or not. What's going to happen going then up to the convention?
That's right. Now, Barbara, Jill wrote us a letter, and she said, "Hi, panel. I am very afraid that if Bernie does not get the nomination for any reason, whether because he concedes, loses in the race for delegates, or worse yet, loses at a contested convention, his supporters will feel cheated and probably not get involved in future politics." And that's from Jill. What do you think of that?
That's what I was saying about the millennials, for whom this is, I guess, their first foray. And, you know, supporting a candidate and how they might just wash their hands of the whole situation.
There is, we do have one letter from Hank.
From Hank. And he says, to Barbara's point, the millennials will start voting after Trump's first 4 years. I get it.
Good point, Hank.
So the thing I wanted to mention was during this interview that I watched on CNN last night with Chris Cuomo and Hillary Clinton, was she was asked about Bernie Sanders and running and so forth, and she made two interesting points. One point was that in her running against President Obama, then Senator Obama in 2008, she won 9 out of the last 11 contests. So, and still ended up losing the nomination. She also made the point that when her supporters were polled, 40% of her supporters said they would not support They would not support President Obama. And what happened, she said, is that I had to work very hard, and then Senator Obama had to work very hard in making the case so that that 40% voted for him. And she said, and I hope the same thing happens here.
Right.
To
I
me,
saw that
seemed like a very reasoned argument,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Mm-hmm. I saw that interview.
So, Alan, now, is that possible, or is it a different, is that an apples and oranges comparison?
It all comes down to character. What's Bernie's character like? Is he like the general in the Bridge on the River Kwai? Has he now gotten so involved in winning that he can't see the forest for the trees? Or does he think that four Supreme Court nominees might be a very important thing? Look, I voted for the guy, but now is the time, says Rich says, and I want you to hear this, Bernie, as one of the uneducated masses, if Bernie is not on the ballot, I will be voting for Trump. How's that?
So, okay, so explain that to me. And yeah. Barbara, I will first pose this to you as a Bernie supporter, which is, how can you be so passionate about Bernie Sanders and his message and possibly find a parallel to Donald Trump?
I can't explain that because I don't understand it myself.
I do.
Okay.
They're both outsiders. They both are anti-system, yeah. And that's what this is about.
And that's what people say. But the thing is, once you, you know, kind of dig into it a little bit, like, you know, taking the endorsement of David Duke versus... Do you see what I'm saying?
I completely see what you're saying. That's I don't understand. I don't get that.
Yeah, I mean, a protest vote that goes 180 degrees is just really.
Well, except Barbara, that last letter sold it all. Proudly, he said, as one of the uneducated masses. Read that. I don't know anything about politics. I don't want to. I'm just angry, and I'm going to vote for an outsider. That's what he was saying.
I just don't believe that. And again, this is not, you know, my end of the spectrum, but I just don't believe that by the time we get to November, after everything that will have been said and after all the debates, I cannot believe that people who have been part of the Democratic Party are not going to ultimately vote for their standard bearer.
Yeah, but Rich, what about the people in the middle?
Well, the people in the middle are the ones who make the election, right?
So, that's right.
There's a lot of people in the Democratic Party who might not consider themselves far-left liberals. There's a lot of people in the Republican Party who might not consider themselves far-right conservatives. And but I don't see either of those people being disaffected enough by the absence of Bernie, for example, to actually pull the lever for the other side. I could see them staying home, which I could see that being more, and that to me is a concern.
Yeah, I think that's a more likely outcome.
But I don't see him going the other way.
But I also think that that Obama and Clinton were closer politically in 2008 than Bernie and Clinton.
And Kenny writes to us. And Kenny writes to us and says, those kinds of voters are more intent on punishment than thinking this through. I think that's an interesting observation.
Well, they would be punishing a lot of us.
I go back to say, look, I live in New York. You know, my electoral votes are going to Hillary no matter who I pull the lever for. And I think maybe to Alan's point and a little bit to Barbara's, maybe people will think differently, those middle, the non-affiliated people. Maybe they'll think differently if they are people in true battleground states.
Yes.
But I can understand some people in New York saying, hey, you know what? Hillary's going to win it anyway, but I'm going to show her I'm unhappy and either not vote or vote for the other side. But I think in battleground states, I think there might be a different analysis.
Right.
We heard from RWS, Robert. Do you know that when a siren goes by on the street outside your studio, 1,000 people look in their rearview mirror? Well, that's very funny, except that the siren isn't where you guys are. It's where I am.
It's the undisclosed location, which makes you wonder what's going on in the undisclosed location.
It means that the team we've sent out is starting to circle around Alan.
Okay. There's a lot of anti-Hillary attitude among people who are doing the Bernie to Trump switch. And that's Matt from Clifton Park. And Joan says, let me share a comment I made on Facebook. This isn't about you or me or I. When you grow up, you set those pronouns for the collective, which is a socialist idea, by the way. You will suffer, not me. I've lived my life and have watched civil rights proudly progress until now and on and on. But I get the point. I think we all do.
And Michael wants Bernie for VP. Seems like a no-brainer to me. Hillary needs to make Bernie her vice presidential candidate. That would almost guarantee a win.
No. I mean, Bernie will get, he might get a, he might, you know, get himself a cabinet seat out of this, though, right?
I doubt it.
You don't think so? Labor? Nah. Come on.
Well, you see, the point is, if you name the, if you name Bernie as the vice presidential candidate, which isn't going to happen, I agree with you, then at least you get the Bernie voters on board. If you have to wait for the cabinet, you know, how does that help in the election?
Because they'll announce it. And Hillary doesn't need, other than politically, Hillary doesn't need somebody from the Senate as a vice president. Whereas, you know, so you could argue that Trump, you know, needs somebody who's familiar.
Served, who ran for office and served.
And familiar with the Senate rules and things like that, and can kind of play in that club. But I don't you think she gets the same, Barbara? Doesn't she get the same bump if she says, you know, we've spoken, you know, I'm going to assimilate his ideas and to show you how serious, you know, he's going to be, you know, labor secretary or, you know, HHO or something.
Do people announce cabinet posts before they're
they
elected?
They do every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I don't know if it's the same bump or not. And it's because it's so implausible to conceive of that this would ever happen. I don't really have much to say about
what,
it.
That
she would pick him for her vice president.
Oh, yeah, no, I agree.
I imagine that happening, so it's hard to think about what would it mean, how would it be. It's just like.
But don't you think a cabinet post is more realistic?
As far as, like, could it happen? Yes, of course it is, yeah.
But, by the way, I'm not so sure a guy like Bernie would want a cabinet post. I mean, you know, he's quite an independent voice in the Senate.
But it's the ask that gets her. You know, it's like when you send out wedding invitations to people who you know live far away. You know, okay, they're not going to come, but at least we're going to get a gift. So you know, you're going to get the Hillary by making the ask, right? Get that? Isn't that an olive? Would you? Well, you're a Bernie supporter. Is that an olive branch to the Bernie supporters?
Nah,
or is that not enough?
Nah, I don't really see
these
it that
angry.
Way.
No, people
I'm with
really
Alan
angry.
On this. Really? I don't just. Yeah, it doesn't sound
and we're hearing,
plausible.
I said it. Jeff says, good morning, panel. Alan, Alec Guinness was a colonel in that movie. Yeah, so Rich is correct. New York will go blue. I said it before. I'll say it again. Huh? Okay, whatever. And Dan says, Paul Revere, I wish WMC would just get on board and make Philadelphia a repeat of Chicago in the 60s. Looking forward to attending. So Rich, says Mike. No matter whom you vote for, New York's electoral votes will go to Hillary. Thank you for making my argument for abolishing the Electoral College. And Kenny says, majority leader? Huh? And then question mark, best Kenny. Huh? Linda says.
Well, they say Bernie would be a majority leader? I don't think that could work, right?
That ain't going to happen.
That's not how that happens.
The majority leader is going to be, first of all, the Senate has to go Democratic.
That's
second
correct.
Of all, and second of all, it's going to be Schumer. We know that already. Does anybody think, says Linda, of Gore versus Bush and Ralph Nader's part? I do. And you can go online and look up Allen and Nader, and you'll hear a screaming match around that election. So, like that.
All right, let's take a break. We'll pause there. We'll come back. We have some other important issues to discuss, and we will do that right after this.
Support for WMC comes from Shedman, building outdoor storage sheds and gazebos delivered fully assembled locations in New Lebanon and Brunswick, New York. Shedman.com for inventory. Capital Region Parade of Homes, featuring tours of 12 designed custom homes constructed by area builders to benefit Center for Disabilities Services, June 4th and 5th, and June 11th and 12th. CapitalRegionParadeOfHomes.com. And Gloversville Sewing Center, Gloversville and Saratoga Springs, New York. A quilt shop offering Bernina and Janome sewing machines. GloversvilleSewingCenter.com. We're worth the trip.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Shartok is here. So is Barbara Smith. So is Rich Honan. And we welcome your calls, roundtable at WAMC.org. Not your calls, your letters, actually. Let me, two stories to talk about. One is the story out of Oklahoma, which I think is a very interesting case. The Oklahoma legislature has passed a bill making it a felony to perform abortions. Lawmakers in Oklahoma on Thursday approved this bill that would make performing abortions a felony and revoke the medical licenses of most physicians who assist in such procedures. The sweeping measure, which opponents described as unconstitutional and unprecedented, now heads to Governor Mary Fallon, a Republican. She will have 5 days, not including Sunday, to decide whether to sign the bill, veto it, or allow it to become law without her signature, according to a spokesman. My immediate read on this was it sounds unconstitutional, but what do you think?
I think it's, and again, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but it sure sounds clearly unconstitutional. And I actually, enough to the point where I read the article on that, and then I was doing a lot of research on it. I was trying to figure out, you know, what's the backstory on this? You know, apparently they had had a similar law that had gone to litigation back in January, and it seems so. Regardless of where you stand on the issue, it seems to me it is blatantly unconstitutional. It's almost like they all got together and passed a law that wasn't even close. You know, say, all right, we're going to do it. In fact, to the point where part of the law included money set aside to fight the constitutional challenge that they knew was going to come. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just it was inexplicable to me.
So it's explicable to me. I'll tell you right now, they don't care it's unconstitutional. They know that their constituents or that the ones that they're playing to will applaud them for doing it. And they say, sure, go ahead and tell us it's unconstitutional. And then we'll make the argument, well, we tried.
I want to go to Barbara, and I just want to give this. The bill passed the Oklahoma House of Representatives with a vote of 59-9 last month. On Thursday, the state Senate passed it by a vote of 33-12.
Right. What I was going to say, listening to Rich, is that I'm thinking, so sorry, I guess we're all hoarse today. Yeah. I was thinking about another possible benefit, which is the chilling effect, perhaps, by having a law like this. How does that affect people's decisions to how they practice medicine going forward? I mean, to me, anybody who's smart enough to be a physician should be smart enough to know what's constitutional or not. But still, there's so many stresses and so many sanctions that are put on physicians,
right,
and medical providers and clinics, the trap laws, etc. It's like the constitutional law doesn't matter when they figure out the ways to burrow underneath,
right,
and get the same results. So.
Just another form of intimidation, coercion, and in a group of physicians, by the way, the OBGYN world, which is among the most heavily litigated against, mm-hmm, on the civil side. It almost seemed, just reading it, it just seemed to me that it was so clearly over the top. I don't have enough background in kind of the politics of that state. I know that the governor there is very anti, reproductive rights,
right,
and that comes across. But it's almost like they made it so over the top that people could vote for it, knowing almost like it was something they would show their constituents, but it was never going to pass constitutional,
right,
muster. Somebody's,
right,
somebody's going to go into court the next day, get,
right,
an injunction, and then,
right,
it'll never be seen again. Did,
right,
you get that feeling at all?
Yeah, kind of like Texas seceding from the United States, like one of those votes.
Yeah.
Well, the tax, though, and we do have another story, I think, that we'll be talking about in a couple of minutes. I just feel like these attacks on rights and what's understood to be rights, it's just very dangerous.
Well, the other story that we were talking about is the House floor. This is from The Washington Post. The House floor is turning into an emotional and at times ugly battleground over LGBT rights as Democrats accuse Republicans of promoting bigotry and discrimination over proposals GOP leaders say are intended to protect freedom of religion from government outreach. The conflict erupted on Thursday when Republican leaders successfully whipped their members to vote down a Democratic amendment that sought to prevent taxpayer dollars from being used to pay contractors that discriminate against employees on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. The proposal, authored by Representative Sean Maloney, a Democrat of New York, an openly gay member of Congress, appeared on the cusp of being adopted as the vote came to a close. But at the last minute, six Republican members switched their votes, and the amendment was defeated by a 212 to 213 vote. Outraged Democrats shouted shame and accused Republican leaders of abusing chamber rules by holding the vote open until they could twist enough arms to kill the amendment. Barbara.
Well, it's just it's appalling to me because this was what, you just said it. It was construction contracts, military construction contracts, that tax money was not going to be used to pay contractors who discriminated against a group of Americans, right? And the thing is, the other side, the Republicans, they are so bent on fanning this divisiveness and this bigotry against people who are not like themselves, that they will, they'll go to any ends, I think, to carry that out. And just think about if it had been a bill or an amendment that said we're not going to use tax money to pay contractors who discriminate because of race. People would be appalled by that, right?
Well, but they wouldn't have to be because that's already part of the law. Mm-hmm. And I think, and unsurprisingly, I have a somewhat different take. Mm-hmm. And my take, Barbara, is not based on the substance of the issue, but a little bit procedurally. This was legislation based upon an executive order. In other words, so President Obama issued an executive order, and you know that regardless of which side you stand on, there has been concern raised about the use of executive orders. And then instead of this being something that would implement legislation, this would be legislation that was implementing an executive order that I'm not sure that everybody agreed with that process in the first place.
Right.
So procedural. Now, I understand that's a far cry from the substance. And
I
don't disagree with you on the substance, mm-hmm. but I don't like the idea of somehow and I'd like to think maybe I would think about this the same way, even if it was an issue that I was, strongly promoting. I don't like the idea of building legislation around an executive order. I'd rather say if it's going to be the law, have it be the law. I mean, I don't know why, sexual orientation is not protected under federal law. Right. Gender discrimination is, but you generally don't have a right of action based on certain types of sexual orientation discrimination under federal law. Now, many states, New York, for example, has its own laws. But I would rather go right to the root of it and say, let's have a discussion on protecting sexual orientation and LGBTQ rights. I'd rather have that openly as a legislative debate and not based upon an executive order.
Well, then it isn't going to happen. And that's why you see Obama doing this, because he's so frustrated by the fact that the Republicans won't let it happen. They listen to people. And in this case, Rich, I don't mean to insult you, but making the same line, which is, OK, I'd rather see something else, which I know won't lead to the things that it should lead to. I mean, look, let's face it. That's a Republican majority by a lot in the House of Representatives, and it ain't going to work.
But at least having the debate first, I would I would say, when you say it ain't going to happen, I would say at least openly having the debate, I think that could happen. The other thing is, Alan, I have to say, this is part of a pattern that I've seen where we're trying to have a discussion, not we, the legislatures the American people want a substantive discussion. And preceding that discussion, the administration has done something to poison the well. Here it was. So this measure comes up a week or so after the heavily disputed, I'll call it disputed, letter that the Obama administration sent down to every school district.
Right.
And you wonder now. If they really wanted to have a significant discussion, why would they send out that letter which raised a lot of issues before having this discussion. Wouldn't you rather, Barbara, have had this discussion on the Senate floor or on the House of Representatives floor before the well was poisoned by that letter?
Well, come on! It wasn't poisoned because of the letter. It was poisoned because of them. And I got to tell you, we've heard from Barbara, who said, "I think the bathroom bills, the abortion, and LGBT rights is a bring out the vote issue," and I agree with her.
What I was going to say is that I think that executive order about transgender access to appropriate bathrooms was catalyzed by North Carolina. So I think it was. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no,
so,
I do.
Yeah,
I do.
So the thing is to say, let's wait. Who knows? It's just, I guess, you know.
But it's a week. We're talking a week, right, before we have this discussion. And I really do believe that. And I can make the same argument on the immigration discussion, where I would argue that an executive order poisoned the well for significant discussion. Now, we weren't getting far on it in the first place. I understand that. But I don't like that play in the playbook. I really don't.
Well, the thing is, I keep thinking historically about the fact that Congress never would pass an anti-lynching bill, nor would the president at the time, which I believe was Woodrow Wilson, nor would he issue an executive order or any statement condemning lynching. So to me, I'm not opposed to executive orders toward more rights and more justice. But I can understand. I understand your point of view. Because I'm arguing the content and the justice issues, you're arguing the procedures, and I absolutely do understand what you're saying about the procedures.
I wonder historically if the Emancipation Proclamation, right, if that would have had the power that it did without the passage of the 13th Amendment. Afterwards, the actual constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. What if they had not been able to pass that constitutional amendment? would the Emancipation Proclamation have had the kind of the massive power that it did?
I agree completely with you. I agree, and it was hard enough as it was. They passed it, and we still had 100 years of Jim Crow.
Right, exactly.
So. Just for the record, I don't agree with either of you. And I think what the president did was courageous. I think the Republicans weren't going to move on it. You could have had all the discussion you wanted, and they would have done what they did. I just don't agree with you. I think you're wrong.
Well, we'll end there. We're out of time, but thank you very much. Alan, thank you.
Thank you.
Barbara, thank you very much for being here. Rich, we'll see you on Monday. And we'll be back with more program after this.